This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Robin Wright. She's an expert on the Middle East. She's been reporting there for more than 30 years now. And she has a new book out. It's quite an interesting book called Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Robin Wright, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's nice to be with you.
I always like to start these interviews with getting to know you a little better, your background. How'd you get into journalism in the first place?
Oh, it's a funny story. I joined the student paper at the University of Michigan, and I wrote sports. My father had only girls, and he took us to all the sporting events. So it was the one way in my day, which was before Title IX, that a female could actually be involved in the sports world.
Yeah, I was just talking with my sister over the weekend, who was the best athlete in the family of eight kids, perhaps the best athlete in the whole neighborhood, but it was a time when she couldn't find a proper channel for that, and she was just bemoaning that fact the other day. You were in Beirut in 1983 when those barracks were blown up. Tell me about that.
I can still remember the thundering explosion that ripped across the capital in Lebanon, you know, about 6:30 in the morning, and there were actually two of them back-to-back. First hit were the Marines and then the French compound. Peacekeepers who'd come to Lebanon in the aftermath of Israel's invasion to try to separate the Lebanese and Palestinians from the Israeli military troops who were still there. And it was the largest non-nuclear explosion anywhere on Earth since World War II. It was the largest loss of U.S. military life in a single incident since Iwo Jima in World War II. And still to this day, that's still true, despite Iraq and Afghanistan.
Robin Wright, as a reporter, why don't you take me on that day for a second, if you could. What did you do when you heard the explosions?
Well, one had a sense that there was something major that had been attacked, and the issue was just waiting for the radio. I have a very good friend who was a peacekeeper, an Italian peacekeeper, part of the larger multinational force, and he told me what had happened, and we all raced down to the Marine compound. And, you know, for weeks it was a matter of standing there and watching as rescue efforts happened, trying to pull these huge concrete slabs off from a huge four-story building where the Marines had been asleep at that hour. And it was more than, I think, 10 days before they even began to release some of the names. And in the meantime, families didn't even know whether their sons had lived or died.
And you knew some of the people there?
Oh, I knew many of them. I mean, all of these attacks. I was there for the first U.S. embassy attack, the Marine compound, and then the second embassy attack in Lebanon. Those were the first three attacks by Islamic extremists. And I had friends at all three. So these were not abstract, you know, events. And that's why I decided to look for who was responsible, why this was happening, why my nation was being targeted, and really to try to get deeper into, you know, what phenomena was being born here.
And what is that phenomenon?
Well, I think it's what we still see today, saw on 9/11. It started one narrow sliver and has proliferated among a wide array of groups. We tend to forget that their primary target is usually the local government. Al-Qaeda's first target is Saudi Arabia. We end up being targeted as secondary focus because we're the props that keep a lot of these regimes in power.
I mean, you know, that was a debate within Al-Qaeda whether to go to the near enemy or the far enemy, as they were calling it, the near enemy being either Saudi Arabia or Israel, and the far enemy being the United States. But in this book, Dreams and Shadows, you make the argument that the appeal of Al-Qaeda and the appeal of these suicide bombers, the appeal of Islamic terrorism is fading. And why do you assert that?
Well, look, I'm not unrealistic. I think there are going to continue to be suicide attacks against American targets and Western targets for the foreseeable future, not only overseas, but potentially, again, even in the United States. But I think something very interesting has happened 7 years after 9/11, and that is that the majority, vast majority of Muslims have begun to recognize that these groups can destroy, they can confront, but they can't provide the tangible, concrete solutions to the problems of everyday life. The mantra of the election in this country is, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And to a certain degree, that's happened even in the Middle East, where poverty and problems of daily life are far graver than they are for us. And people have begun looking for other alternatives. The problem is they confront autocratic regimes, so they have the challenge not only of not engaging in extremism, but then finding some means of change when the regimes in power refuse to open up in any way.
And so those who advocate change nonviolently but assertively can find themselves in jail and have traditionally over the last 30, 40 years.
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite characters in the book is a man named Riyad Turk, and he's the Nelson Mandela of Syria. And here's a guy who has repeatedly called for reform, political openings, free press, and eventually even regime change in Damascus, and has been jailed time and time again. And the third time he was jailed, he was held in a cell the size of an elevator with no windows, no furniture, no toilet, no bed. He had no idea how long he was going to be held. He had no paper, no pencil, no books, no lawyer, no contact with his wife, no trial. So he, you know, it was an open-ended thing. And he kept his sanity by taking the uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night and using them to draw geometric designs on the floor of his cell every day. And he did that for 18 years. And he came out at the age of 68. And what did he do? He went out and started protesting again. And he went back to jail again. I mean, there are an enormous number of brave people. We often look at the Middle East in terms of our strategic interests. We look at Syria for its meddling in Lebanon, it's playing the spoiler on Arab-Israeli peace and for facilitating foreign fighters into Iraq. But we have made the mistake repeatedly as a country of not looking at what's going on inside each one of these countries and seeing how dynamic some of the movements for change really are.
Robin Wright, this is a problem not only at the policy level, it's also a problem at the level of consciousness of the American people who don't recognize within each of these countries the fundamental truth that you're talking about right now, that Edward Said has written about and a lot of other scholars of the Middle East have written about, that in each of these countries, they are very complex, there are different currents and cross currents, and there is a fight for democracy going on in each of these. And somehow we need to get that through to people. And this book helps in that way. One of the things you talk about is that a change in the Middle East is going to come under the rubric one way or another of Islam. And that may disappoint people who have a crude interpretation of what or concept of what Islam is. But one of the things that's interesting about this book is you talk about the moves to reinterpret Islam, and there's a word that sounds a little bit like jihad that's going on as far as reinterpreting Islam. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, it is. It's the reinterpretation. Ijtihad is something that you find going on in lots of different ways. Turkey, for example, has a whole array of international scholars looking at Muslim traditions and trying to, as they call it, sort them out, find out which ones were, you know, really reflective of the time Islam was born in the 7th century, and which were added sometimes centuries later with little justification, little sense of any relationship to the Prophet Muhammad and the founding of the faith, and to find out, therefore, which are the ones that are most reliable and which aren't. And the interesting thing is many of the ones that are most questionable are the ones added late, and they involve women's rights. And so that is addressing one of the many most controversial issues about the Islamic faith.
There is this big feminist reinterpretation of Islam going on.
Oh, it's very, very interesting how women have become one of the two engines of change in the region, along with youth. The Middle East has the youngest population in the world, and one out of three of them is unemployed. But women are astounding in the dynamic challenges that they're, as political candidates, as feminists, as writers, as filmmakers. In Iran, they have an expression, the real men in Iran are women.
And we know, we hear about Shireen Ebadi. We've been fortunate enough to interview her at the Progressive. She's this Nobel Prize winner. What is she like?
Oh, she's played a very important role. And this is, again, a female human rights lawyer, who won the Nobel for defending dissidents, demanding free speech, and being intrepid in not allowing the Ayatollahs to run over her clients and run over herself. Now, she's faced personal danger, all kinds of threats, statements insinuating anti-government activity from the government. But she perseveres. And there are a lot of women now trying to organize a million signatures to demand changes in laws involving women's rights in Iran. Same thing has already happened in Morocco. So we're seeing even the conservative sheikhdoms in the Persian Gulf having to at least give lip service to conditions for women.
Why is that? Why couldn't they just repress them?
Well, I think because of education, because of technology, frustration. There's a sense among those in the Middle East today, they know what's happened elsewhere in the world with the demise of communism in Eastern Europe, the end of military dictatorships in Latin America, the end of apartheid in South Africa, that there is change elsewhere. And many people in the region want to be part of what they see as a global trend. Now, that doesn't mean naively that they're looking for the same kind of democracy we have. They're looking for change. I think because Islam is often going to be an idiom of political opposition, that we're not likely to we'll see more restrictions in societies. They don't want a totally free press that would allow pornography, for example. They don't want to allow alcohol in many of their societies. It varies from country to country. There's no standard formula. But there's a real difference today between people who turn to Islam as a political idiom and others who turn to Islamism or extremism. And that's something we in the United States haven't got a grip on. We're so afraid of anything that says Islam that we tend to think it automatically means militancy, when in fact, I think at the end of the day, Islam may often be the solution to Islamism, that people will turn to their faith for change, but not using violence to achieve it.
I'm speaking with Robin Wright. She's the author most recently of this interesting book called Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, and she's been reporting from the Middle East for many papers, including the Washington Post, for more than 30 years now. Can we talk a little bit more about Iran? You have another one of those interesting, incredibly brave dissidents there named Ganji. Tell us about him.
Well, Ganji is a journalist among the people who are trying to reform in Iran. And he was one of those who backed the revolution, even during the Iran-Iraq War, was a member of the Revolutionary Guards, but quickly became disillusioned with the authoritarian nature of the Islamic regime. And he began writing articles, questioning it, doing investigative reporting, and he did a series on corruption among the senior clerics who rule in Iran, which ended him up in jail. And he went on a hunger strike, wrote a manifesto that he managed to get out of jail because he has many supporters even in the prison system. And this galvanized people around the idea of reform. And he's been incredibly brave.
Now, when Americans hear about Iran, they basically think one thing. If they aren't thinking to the hostage crisis back in 1979, they think about Ahmadinejad. And what is your evaluation of him? You write about him in this book, of course.
And I've seen him twice when he's come to the United Nations, had been at dinners for him and been engaged in discussions, interviews.
I mean, one of those dinners, he was really outrageous on the Holocaust.
Yes, it was a stunning conversation. Maurice Greenberg, who was a survivor of the Holocaust, his family, many members of his family died. And he asked the first question and said, "Mr. President, how can you deny the Holocaust? It is the best documented case of genocide and human rights abuse in human history." And Ahmadinejad turned to him and said, "And how old are you, Mr. Greenberg?" And Maurice said, "Well, I'm 81. And Ahmadinejad then said, "Ah, and you're still alive," as if that was proof that the Holocaust hadn't happened. It was chilling, and it's hard to find the right adjective to describe someone who engages in that, which is why I often tell that anecdote.
Yeah, it is an astonishing one. What is his popular base right now? I know he came to power, you said, on the wave of an anti-elite vote.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things to happen in the Middle East are both the Iranian and Palestinian elections, which came up within months of each other, where people turned out and voted for parties that are of great concern to us, Ahmadinejad in Iran, Hamas in the Palestinian territories, who were elected by a no vote. In Iran, people have been debating for a decade the turban versus the hat, religious clerics versus when were they going to have the first lay leader, secular leader elected as president. And the vote in Iran was a rejection of the clerics. A man, his competition was a former president named Rafsanjani, a legendary man who was once labeled a moderate. But he is also representative of the kind of corruption that is now prevalent across Iran.
And it was a class thing too, right? He was a pistachio trader and rich upper-class family.
Right. And I think people voted for Ahmadinejad not knowing what his policy was on, nuclear weapons or nuclear energy, but because he'd been mayor of Tehran for 2 years and had cleaned up some of the corruption and was pretty good on garbage collection and had delivered. And so they were looking for Mr. Clean rather than Mr. Corrupt and ended up with someone who was very hard line. Now, he does have a constituency and he's among the Revolutionary Guards, the militant side of the revolution. And the big question is, will he be reelected? He faces a contest next June. Iran has 2 term limits, 4 years each, just as we do here. And it'll be very interesting, given the economic problems in Iran today, whether...
Is there a reformist running against him who has a chance?
We don't know all the candidates yet. Iran's political campaign tends to be less than 2 weeks.
Oh, that's something we could get used to here.
And candidates often don't announce until, weeks beforehand. Or if they do, they go through a sorting out process in Iran of candidates, which is always manipulates the election to a certain extent.
And to what extent does Ahmadinejad run the show there, or do the clerics run the show?
Well, that's a very good question. At the end of the day, Ahmadinejad is just one among many. The real power in Iran is held by the supreme leader, who has infallible powers, and it's basically a lifelong appointment. And he can disqualify candidates, overturn legislation, and override a presidential decision. So the president, for example, is just one member of its National Security Council, whereas in the United States, the president is head of the National Security Council and makes all the decisions.
I'm speaking with Robin Wright. She's the author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Robin Wright, you mentioned the elections in Palestine just a bit ago with Hamas's surprise victory. I know Condoleezza Rice said, who could have seen this coming just after 9/11. She said, who could have flown planes into buildings? Who could have foreseen that? Was this a failure of U.S. policy to encourage those elections, or was it important to get it done anyway?
Well, you can argue that for a long time. I think the most important thing to understand is people went to the polls, just as they did in Iran, rejecting 30 years of clerical rule. In the Palestinian Authority, they went to reject 50 years of domination by Fatah, the prevalent party in the PLO, the one started by Yasser Arafat, and its corruption, its nepotism, and what had become kind of thuggery within the party, a lot of what I call the backstreet boys in their leather jackets, extorting from local businesses, engaging in mafia-like activity. And people are tired of that. So even people who didn't support Hamas wanted to send a strong signal that the traditional parties in the PLO had not served the Palestinians well. And it was striking that they went to the polls peacefully to reject an alternative. Now, I think there was a core of voters who did support Hamas. What gave Hamas the majority was this rejection of the alternative. It was a no vote. And then the Fatah party also put up too many candidates and split its own vote. So for a couple of reasons, Hamas won. But the hard part of it now is you no longer have two parties to the peace process. You have three. And the two Palestinian sides, do not have the same position on Israel, and therefore you don't have a peace process that's really viable at the moment.
Hamas does talk about having a long truce, however, with Israel. And I just wonder if, you know, a lot of people who believe that the United States need, and I believe, the United States needs to put more pressure on the state of Israel to come to a decent agreement with Palestinians and to lean on Israel to stop those settlements and withdraw back to the 67 borders, that those are the outlines of a settlement. What's your opinion on that?
Well, you're correct that this one of the great tragedies of the Arab-Israeli conflict is we've known now for several years what the formula for a solution is going to be, that there will be Palestinians will get some sliver of Jerusalem and the Israelis are likely to keep a good chunk of the West Bank. Palestinian refugees will not be allowed to return, but they'll get some kind of compensation package, probably funded by the West, the outside world. The problem is you haven't seen the momentum, the energy, commitment by the United States particularly to get the two sides together. And now we're going through leadership changes in both Israel and the Palestinians are supposed to have elections in January. And Mahmoud Abbas is 70 and has indicated sometimes that he may not run. We're in for, you know, a lot of change. And it's too bad we haven't taken greater opportunity to try to resolve this because I think it would change many of the dynamics. I think the majority of people on both sides still want peace, still are committed to trying to find a way and understand the basic outlines, as you've pointed out.
So there's virtually no chance of the Bush-Rice initiatives bearing fruit in this period of flux, do you think?
None.
None whatsoever. Now, in the greater Middle East, if there is no solution to giving Palestinians a just state of their own, I mean, that tends to be an open sore throughout the region, isn't it? And how palpable is that?
Oh, it's very palpable. It's the one cause that unites the wider Arab world, and even Iran is thrown into the match, even though it's a Persian country, not Arab. And it's a sore point throughout the broader Islamic world. It's the one thing that the United States could do, I think, fastest and even as complicated it is, and most effectively to change the dynamics. Issues like dealing with Iraq and the security of the Gulf countries, Iran's nuclear program, are much longer-term challenges that we're going to be involved in, but the one we could do the most in changing the dynamics quickly is on the Arab-Israeli conflict.
I'm speaking with Robin Wright. Her new book is called Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. You just brought up Iraq, and the one bone I have to pick with you about the book is going easy on Bush in the lead-up to the Iraq War, because it's a very abbreviated part of the book, and you say that Saddam Hussein wouldn't let UN inspectors go through the country and then, you know, basically in the next paragraph, the war's starting. And to my mind, you know, Saddam Hussein at the end was letting the UN weapons inspectors go pretty much everywhere they wanted and they weren't finding anything.
No, it was a very brief period, and he was blocking them. Again, they were not providing the documents, and the when he said that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, he didn't tell anyone what had happened to the programs that they knew existed. This was a great bluff, and it's the great tragedy for the Iraqi people and, frankly, for the American people that we got, because of Saddam's bluff, we went ahead with a war, which may well be viewed by history as the greatest mistake the United States has made in foreign policy.
But that's just the question, not to belabor it too much. Was it because of Saddam's bluff that we went to war? Is it because Bush always wanted to go to war and used, you know, whatever he could seize on to start the war?
You know, I don't know what was in Bush's head. Some like to say it was because of, you know, a threat to his father's life. I don't think it was that simple. I think that in the aftermath of 9/11, in the aftermath of what looked like a quick military victory in Afghanistan and ousting the Taliban, there was a sense that this was a moment to go after others and that we were mightier than we proved to be. It was a horrible mistake. We relied on a group of exiles led by a man who had not been in Iraq since 1958 when he was a teenager. We had not a clue what was going on in Iraq. We had no plan for the future, no vision. And if we were going to invade, we didn't even have a good military plan. We didn't have enough troops to do it right. And we raced into it on our election timetable rather than in terms of giving the time for those weapons inspectors from the UN to go back and really do the job. It was a tiny little window.
What's it been like reporting there? How many times have you been there?
Oh, I don't even count anymore. I've been going to Iraq since 1981, but I've been in the Middle East since 1973. So, yeah, you stop.
I mean, you write at one point, Robin, right, that you weren't comfortable even walking around the green zone.
Oh, well, things have changed. In the immediate aftermath of our intervention, I went in with Colin Powell, and I could leave the green zone, hop in a taxi, drive around the city. But with every trip I went back, there were more and more restrictions, and there were some cases I couldn't even move from one building and cross the street to another inside the green zone. Things were so precarious. Most of my colleagues operate outside the green zone, and that's how journalists really report Iraq. But it's also very dangerous, and many journalists have been killed.
You drop off your narrative, obviously, because of deadlines in Dreams and Shadows in 2007, where things look really grim. By most accounts, they've improved. Do you have a sense of what's going on there now?
Well, I think Iraq is still pretty grim, but I think it's important that the surge has succeeded less because of U.S. troops and more because of what the Iraqis themselves did. The U.S. surge did make progress. It played a significant and important role in facilitating the transition. But the pivotal development was really the Iraqis themselves turning on al-Qaeda, the tribal leaders mobilizing not only themselves in awakening councils, but then recruiting almost 100,000 Iraqis in Anbar province, the most volatile and vulnerable area of Iraq, to join police and military units to chase al-Qaeda, the foreign fighters, out of Anbar. And so the two things coming together really turned Anbar around. The danger in Iraq, and we're far from over, is that the Shiite government has not still included the Sunnis in the political process completely, is trying to dismantle the Awakening Councils and is not absorbing the recruits from that region back into jobs. And so that the potential for strife remains serious.
And it seems that the Iraqi government and a lot of people, if not most people in Iraq, I don't know if that's true, want U.S. troops to go. What would your assessment of that be?
I think it varies from the different communities, and even within communities, there are a wider range of opinions. I think they want combat troops out, that we've worn out, are welcome. That's the feeling among the majority of people. I think there are others, though, who are concerned that without U.S. troops, the Sunnis are concerned that the Shiites, Shiite-dominated government, may not take as good care of them. The U.S. has been paying each of the 100,000 men involved in the Awakening Councils $300 a month, and the Iraqi government doesn't want to pay them and is not offering them alternative jobs. And that, you know, sows the seeds for future strife.
What is the lesson of the Bush administration's Iraq war? Do you think we've got less than a minute?
I think the one lesson, most important lesson, is that to engage in change, to foster change, that it has to be homegrown, that you can't impose ideas or systems from the outside world. The majority of people in the region do want political change, do want economic and political openings, but they also want to be the ones to achieve it themselves.
Robin Wright, thanks so much for being my guest today. Robin Wright is the author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. This is Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.